point out the important terms of where we will be focusing on, and then point out a few gaps and challenges in the police's reports on their performance, and then a few concluding remarks. The Climate Justice Program, I'm not going to go through the whole ISS, I think you know the ISS by now. We in the CJP program, we focus on the criminal justice system as a whole, but also on crime issues in general, crime prevention and so on. And the whole idea is to analyze what we see, to do research and to inform and hopefully to inform and influence policy on these issues. Some of the general comments on this year's annual report, as with the case with previous annual reports, we certainly believe that the police's annual report have evolved over the last number of years into something that's fairly comprehensive and thorough, and it's a very useful source of information on not just the police as an organization, but also on policing as a function and therefore the focus on the performance of the police. The purpose of our submissions, therefore, is to raise some of the performance issues that emerge from these reports and from our monitoring of these reports, and to highlight the gaps. We certainly do not claim to cover every aspect of the report. I think that would require quite an intensive effort, and it would take us more than a day, I think, to go through all of the issues. So we focus on very specific issues. And as I said, for purposes of clarity, I will just briefly look at the layout. Now, we are all fairly familiar with the layout of the report. There's been some changes in this year's report. But pages 1 to 118 covers what the police refer to as predetermined objectives, and specifically the five programs that you see. Most of our analysis for this briefing is focused on the first three: administration, visible policing, and the detective service. Also, we have not specifically looked at the financial statements for purposes of this briefing. We covered some aspects of the human resource management section on pages 193 to 221, and also highlighted a few of the areas that we believe need some attention or further clarification. This year, the police also removed the crime report to the back of the report, of the annual report, and it's now Annex A. So it's still there, but it's just in a different place in the report, and then as an annexure, not part of the main body of the report. Also, something that I think will probably change in future reports is pages 30 to 54 of the police's annual report that provides the annual report of the Secretariat of Police. They have their own report as yet. And I think it's important just to remember, Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen, that the Department of Police comprises of four different parts, and the police is only one part of it. And I think reference to the police as the Department of Police is, technically speaking, therefore not correct. So we just need to bear that in mind. The Secretariat, ICD, and CIRA, of course, the other three parts of the department. Makes up the department. Now, if we start with Program 1, Administration, the purpose of this program is to develop policy and manage the department, including the provision of administrative support. This is the issue that we focus on, human resource development, pages 22 to 26. It's very useful in terms of the information that it provides in terms of training on every level of the police, entry level, operational support, management, detectives, etc. Total of 178,870 employees trained. The interesting thing is that with all of these training programs, they have allocated a percentage for competency. Now, in total, and it varies between the different training programs, in total, the number of members found competent is 90.2%. So we believe that some questions need to be asked about this for purposes of clarification and for a number of other reasons as well. And the first question that we think needs to be answered, or asked at least, is what happens to the learners or trainees who fail, who are not found competent in each course? This information is not provided. And that leads to a number of sub-questions. Are these learners or trainees then re-entered for that particular course? Are they given the opportunity? Are they required? How many times does this happen, and how is this process managed? And there are some obvious examples where this might be extremely important. The detectives, for example. I think we all agree that detectives need to have very specific skills, but one of the basic skills they certainly need to have is the ability to write or take down statements properly, and to do all of the other required stuff that needs to go into the investigation of crime, and that needs to go into a docket when this is presented to court, because all of this have implications for the prospects of successful prosecution. And there's no indication what happens to detectives, for example, who fail their basic courses. And I think it's important that we understand what happens to them. The second question then specifically goes to firearms training, and there's no mention in the annual report of firearms training. And the obvious question is, apart from how many police officials receive this training for purposes of competency, keep in mind all police officers must undergo firearms training as part of their training. But then the Firearms Control Act also requires that they complete the competency training and actually be declared competent in order for them to be able to be issued with firearms for which they would otherwise not require a license. So that information is also absent from the annual report. Chairperson, then as far as the human resource planning utilization is concerned, specifically, again, the detectives, the report indicates that the capacity of detectives increased by 11%. From 20,291 to 22,594. What I think is important for us to understand is what the target is for detectives. Although I have not included in this in the presentation, on page 200 of the report, a number is allocated or indicated for the detectives, but probably for the detectives as a whole, that would include also administrative staff, something like 37,000. And it is also then indicated what the vacancy rate is. The vacancy rate is 0.5%. The question, therefore, is, and it's not clear in my presentation itself, so I'm just mentioning or highlighting this, that I think what we need to know is what the target for the detectives, trained detectives, is, and not so much the trainings, the whole detective complement that includes the administrative support staff, but trained detectives. What is the target within the organization? In general, police organizations across the world have something like a 25% allocated to their detectives. So we're not certain what the target is for the detectives in the South African Police Service. And if we look at 22,500, then they may be approaching that target if it is about 25% or a quarter. But I think this needs to be made very, very clear so that we can understand where we are moving towards in terms of staffing the detectives with trained investigators. As far as corruption and fraud prevention is concerned, the SAPS began in the 2009-10 financial year with the implementation of its revised corruption and fraud prevention plan. And in the table that I will show you in the next slide, it shows the figures for members charged for corruption, for defeating the ends of justice, fraud, bribery, extortion in terms of the SAPS disciplinary regulations. So taking all of those together under corruption and fraud prevention. If we look at the table, Chair, ladies and gentlemen, we see that in almost all of these categories there's been visible improvements or increases. Members charged with corruption and related offences, fraud, etc., increased by 31% since they began with the implementation of the revised strategy. The question then is, and it relates to what we've seen in the ICD report as well about increases in police criminality, is what the reasons for this increase could be. Is it because detection is now working better because of the new police strategy plan, or rather anti-corruption plan? Is it because that corruption is simply on the increase within the police service? And although we can speculate about this, I think this is what we need to ask the police to tell us. In the next slide, page 10 of my slides, police criminality and corruption, Chair, you may recall that last year when we presented the submission to the committee, we also pointed out that the information on police corruption, and especially corruption from a criminal point of view, appears to be insufficient. And we therefore made a recommendation that that they provide this kind of information in the format that we suggested last year, and I've just repeated it here, that they should, in the annual report, have a breakdown in terms of police criminality and corruption by indicating the numbers of police officials that have criminal charges opened against them, and then a breakdown of these charges per crime category, as well as the number of cases per category that are referred to court for prosecution. The numbers of convictions per category, as well as the number of police officials that are dismissed and not dismissed after being convicted of a criminal offence, because that leads to a range of other steps that might be required. Also to provide an indication of the resources that the police dedicate to the implementation and monitoring of this anti-corruption strategy or plan. And then finally, measurable indicators of the implementation of the SAPS anti-corruption strategy and its impact. And we believe that the current plan does not supply the information in terms of this breakdown, and we believe that this is important. The second program about on visible policing. The purpose of this program, as indicated in the annual report, is to enable police stations to institute and preserve safety and security, and to provide for specialized interventions and the policing of South Africa's borders. If we look then at the first of these sub headings under which this report is provided. Crime prevention actions on page 65. During the reporting period, the police conducted just under 30,000 crime prevention operations and carried out 1.5 million arrests, or almost 1.5 million arrests for all types of crime. That would be just over 91,000 more arrests than in 2009-2010. And of course, we can speculate that a lot of this has to do with special operations dedicated to the security of the World Cup, as do those operations that are indicated in the table. We can see that there's huge, huge increases. The percentage increases, of course, refer to the increase between the last 2 years. And we can see that in some of those operations or actions were huge increases. The most obvious one is for vehicles searched, where we had 189% increase. Now, again, this may be because of the dedicated effort to securing the Soccer World Cup. But it's interesting that in 2008-2009, we had just over 4 million of these vehicles searched, and it dropped to about half of that in the next year, 2009-10, and then suddenly increased to very close to 8 million in 2010. And it's just a curious occurrence that we had such a huge drop in that specific kind of sub-operation or action. Now, these are certainly impressive figures, and I think we all expected that the police would have this focus on these kinds of operations in the run-up to the World Cup and during the World Cup, and certainly we all saw much higher police visibility in the run-up and right throughout the World Cup, and to some extent also afterwards. But I think what we did identify as something that needs to be done with all of these operations is to try and determine to what extent these operations have had an impact on specific crimes and what those crimes are, and to try and explain how these operations impacted on those specific crimes. Of course, we know that there are many crimes that are in most ways immune from police operations, such as interpersonal violence, for example. Now, possible questions that we think this poses for the police is are the following. How are these actions operations defined and counted? For example, it's a very vague issue at the moment. For some time now, is what constitutes a patrol? Is a patrol something that lasted for a shift, or is it counted differently? Those kinds of guidelines are not provided. The same with searches. What constitutes a search? Is a random search by a police member of a suspected person included in these numbers? Or are these numbers only limited to specific operations? So those things are a little vague and unclear. Following on that point, what systems are in place to ensure accurate reporting and capturing of all of these actions? I think we are a little skeptical that the systems that are in place, or that there are, to be frank, good practices or good systems in place that would enable the police to accurately capture all of these information. And then the last question there, the decrease in the point that I highlighted, 35% in 2008-2009, or then between 2008-2009 and 2009-10, and then the sharp increase in the same category in the next year. I think that warrants some explanation. arrests as a result of police operations, that is covered in pages 65 to 66 of the annual report. As we said, a total of just under 1.5 million arrests were made, of which 688,937 were for priority crimes or serious crimes, and just under 800,000, or 52.6%, for other crimes or less serious crimes. The arrests for selected priority crimes, as indicated in the table that you have in front of you, we also see, apart from property and other serious crimes, we see substantial increases in all of the other categories as far as arrests are concerned. And again, perhaps this reflects to some extent on the World Cup, but there certainly may be other reasons for this. Part of the reasons could be that some of these crime types also increase substantially and therefore are reflected in the higher number of arrests that were made. If we look on page 14 of this presentation, the exception in terms of these increases is that property-related crime, other serious crimes, are slightly fewer. Approximately 1% or 2,500 fewer arrests were carried out. This may be the result of the overall decrease of approximately 5% in property-related crime and other serious crimes, which includes something like commercial crime, for example. Although commercial crime itself went up, most of the other property-related crimes, such as burglary and so on, has come down in the last reported period. The 47.4 arrests for priority crimes is also slightly down from the 48.3% in the previous reporting period, but still indicates that close to half of all arrests are for more serious crimes. Now, you may recall also that not too long ago, I remember towards the end of the 90s and the first year or two or three of this millennium, serious crimes only represented about a third of arrests. So there's been some improvement in this regard, but it also does show that almost half or just over half the arrests that the police do carry out are for less serious crimes. So possible questions, Chairperson, that I think we think could be asked for the police is, when this reflects the national picture, how does the provincial picture look like? Because we've seen that in some provinces we've had substantial increases in some crime types that was completely opposite from the national trend. And it's, I think it may be a useful exercise to try and understand to what extent operations which would include arrests in those provinces that experience increases in the crime level are different from those provinces that experience a decrease in the crime levels. We should also then be able to determine whether there is a correlation between those figures. And I think the purpose of having these figures is not just to understand what the correlation is or isn't between arrests and impact on crime trends, but also how provinces utilize their resources in order to achieve all of these operations. On page 15 of this presentation, we look at lost or stolen firearms by members of the police. And it's interesting that we have seen huge improvement there, a reduction of 65%, from 3,814 in the previous reporting year to 1,335. And this clearly is the result, we believe, of some of the mechanisms implemented by the police in the last year. But it's still an extremely serious situation, keeping in mind that these firearms are probably in the hands of criminals. And we should have a zero figure year, ideally. And of course, there's still a huge room for improvement. So we think that the questions that need to be asked is that in spite of this reduction and in spite of this being a commendable achievement in limiting the loss of firearms to whatever way, we need to determine how many of these are lost because of negligence, because of theft, and even because of criminal behavior by individual police members. We also need to be informed what actions were taken against those who were responsible for these losses in whatever way they were lost, and then how many of these firearms were recovered. On page 16 of this presentation, Chairperson, we look at escapes from police custody. These figures are shown on pages 75 and 76 of the annual report. The number of escapes from police custody decreased significantly in the last 3 years, from 1,144 to 669 in 2010-11. That's a reduction of 41%. And then from 857 in 2009-10, a further reduction of 22%. Six provinces showed decreases. KwaZulu-Natal, there was no change. And then the Free State and Northwest have shown increases in the number of escapes. So possible questions we believe that the police could be asked is what the measures are that are being implemented to address this problem, especially in provinces where escapes have been on the increase again. They do indicate in the annual report that they are taking steps to combat this in the provinces where this is happening, but it would be useful to know what the steps are that they are taking in those provinces and then general. To what extent were escapes due to police negligence or active assistance, and what actions were then taken against those members found to be responsible, either through their negligence or even active assistance? That information, I think, is also important for the annual report. If we go then to Program 3, Detective Services, page 17, the purpose of this program is to enable the investigative work of the SAPS, including providing support to investigators in terms of forensic evidence and the Criminal Records Center. Now, the most obvious omission in this year's annual report is the conviction rates in the tables for the investigation of various crimes, except for commercial crimes. No reason is provided, and we can only assume that this is because conviction rates are not dependent only on the police's performance. On page 86 of the report, SAPS makes it clear that they accept the following two criteria to evaluate the performance of the detectives. That is the detection rate and the number of cases ready for court. We'll see also this is reflected in the tables for general investigations. In line with this approach, the following table sets out the detection rate and percentage of court ready cases for 2010-11. We'll see the three crime types shown there: contact crimes, property-related crimes, and crimes dependent on police action. Because we no longer have conviction rates, the police had to set a new measurements, measurable criteria, and this they now did in terms of percentage cases court ready, and that of course then provides them with a new baseline from which to work. So we can't really read anything from this yet unless we have future information to measure this by. What is interesting, however, is that if we look at crimes dependent on police action, we have a very high percentage, very close to 99%, and of course when this increases, we know that the police are doing their work. One crime type we expect to see increasing, but they have an extremely low percentage for court-ready cases, and it is a very obvious problem that when you have such a huge or very high detection rate, that you have such a low rate of cases ready for court. So the possible question then is that the police should provide their reasons, and it may be completely acceptable reasons, but we don't know for why they've omitted the conviction rates from the annual report, because we believe it is useful for a number of reasons, but it can also assist us in terms of how we reflect on the quality of the detective. The detective, of course, realizing that this cannot be the only criterion in which this is measured. And then also a question on the fairly low rate of cases to court for crimes dependent on police action. On page 19, commercial crime. I think there's some disturbing trends emanating from the table. If we look at the information from 2007-2008 right through to the last reporting period, we see a constant decline in figures. And we believe that this is indicative of a weakening ability within the detectives as far as the investigation of commercial crimes are concerned. If we look, for example, at 2008-09, we see that there were only 37 fewer cases than in the last year, and there were 2,488 more arrests made, and there were 2,097 more persons convicted in that period. So it then raises obvious questions about the reasons why the investigations of commercial crime seems to be on the decline. If we look on page 20 at organized crime, there are some improvements compared to previous years. I think the most obvious question that these figures does give rise to is that in spite of huge increases or improvements in terms of the number of projects initiated and successfully terminated, we've seen a huge decline in the number of syndicate members arrested, from 450 in the previous year to 282, and it's just an obvious problem that you have had an increase in terms of the number of projects successfully terminated, but you have such a huge decrease in the number of syndicate members arrested. In addition to the information in the table, we've seen an increase in 48% in the number of projects. These are just the percentages to highlight the change there and the absence of a correlation there, and a 32% increase in number of projects terminated. The total number of organized crime unit arrests also seem to be inflated by the 2,910 arrests resulting from non-project investigations. In other words, almost 3,000 after 4,600 arrests are arrests for non-project investigations. Now, there may be nothing wrong with that. I mean, as long as we can continue arresting criminals, I think we are fine. But the thinking here was that the focus of the organized crime unit would be on project-related investigations, so it would be useful for us to know from them more about how it is that they arrest more people through non-project investigations than for project-related investigations. Now, this is the same for convictions where we've seen that of the 1,076 convictions, 700 were also for non-project investigations. So the questions there, I think, are fairly obvious that there appears to be discrepancy in the successes with projects against the drop in arrests of syndicate leaders, and then perhaps the police can clarify the mandate of the organized crime unit in terms of investigations for registered projects and for non-project investigations. On page 22, we look at human resource management under labor relations, specifically disciplinary hearings for misconduct, pages 209 and 217 of the report. We see that there is a constant increase in the number of disciplinary hearings, and we believe that this perhaps may correlate with the annual increase in the numbers of police. So when you increase the number of the police, that you may then increase or have an increase in the number of police officials who commit acts of misconduct and other things that they are then charged for in terms of the disciplinary code of the police. The interesting point, however, is that the police numbers increased by only 2.3% over the last year, whereas the number of hearings increased by 32%. So there's a huge difference between the numbers with which the police increased and the increase of police officials who are trialed for disciplinary action. So I think this is something we believe that the police should also explain perhaps a little more. And part of this question is actually a number of sub-questions. Whether this is simply a question of more effective detection of this kind of misconduct, or whether there is improvements in terms of command and control, whether the police disciplinary structures are functioning more efficiently, or even when whether this might be a reflection on the quality of staff recruited by the police, keeping in mind that last year the National Commissioner said publicly that in the quest to increase the numbers of the police forfeited quality in favor of quantity. And the question is this then proof of what he said in his statement? Chairperson, my last slide, few concluding remarks. As we said in the introduction, we by no means imply that this is an exhaustive analysis, but its aim is, by highlighting some of the issues that we did to assist the work of this committee, in addition to work by other institutions that provide their submissions, and then to identify the weaknesses and gaps in the report. We also would like to use this opportunity to thank the police for this report and for making this these copies available to us, knowing that we would be analyzing it and highlighting some of the issues. And we just hope that they accept that we only are trying to assist them also to improve the quality of our future reports. And then finally, Chairperson and members of the committee, the Institute wishes to express our appreciation also for this committee for giving us the opportunity to provide you with a submission on our analysis. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Quite interesting. Members, do you want to ask any clarifying questions? Honorable Ndlovu, Honorable Annelies, Honorable Lekgetho. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. On slide number 9, Chairperson, Tuzabega, you're asking a possible question which maybe you can elaborate on it. You are talking about the number, that's slide number 9. You are talking about the number of police charged with corruption related to offense increases by 31%. But you are asking a question. Now, I'm just asking a question to you. Maybe you'll understand it the way I'm thinking about it. Is the corruption increases in the department, or is it a detective from their part? What do you think it will be? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Dr. Berger, for the presentation as well. My question is related to the detectives. Detectives and crime intelligence, you haven't really referred to crime intelligence, but if I may pose a question on that issue as well. When the criminal justice revamp was done, it was suggested then at that time, now we all know it's a couple of years back, that the police ideally should have in the region of 30,000 detectives. At that stage, it was rejected by SAPS. Now, you said that globally it's about 25% of the service. Now, we're currently at 190-something police officers, which would mean that we are way, way under 25 even. I mean, we're talking about more than 40,000 detectives to get to the 25% of it. In your mind, given that the minister has declared a policy that policing should be based on intelligence, with detective services supporting that as well, I think an approach that we all agree is helpful. And given also the fact, I saw you were here this morning, that when the presentation was made, the lack of crime intelligence officers. How do we prioritize, and how do we get those figures in line? You know, what in your mind, as an expert also, is what we should be working at? I'm also worried because our own experience is that detectives, even though there might be 22,000 detectives currently, are not trained. And that at some stations we know our figures say that it will take 10, 20, 30 years to train the detectives at that station, given the capacity to train detectives. And I agree with you, and I think we all agree with you, that a fully trained detective is an effective detective. Your input as an expert, what are we looking at? What time period should we be looking at so that we can also have a target for ourselves, determine a target for ourselves? When do we reach what target, ideally? Can I also ask you a question related to this? My own view, personal view, I believe we've got enough police officers. I don't believe that we should expand our police service in terms of numbers further, but that we should start looking at quality and well-trained officers, and that we must utilize what we have to the capacity. Your point of view in terms of what we have, what ideally we should have in terms of police officers.
Thank you, Chair. Let me take the opportunity to thank Dr. Berger on the presentation. The Institute for Security Studies is quite big, and I must appreciate that you will be here to advise us. But my little concern is that I see you are alone. Where are the other people, particularly women? Thank you. My second question relates to slide number 20, on page 20, where you talk about syndicate members arrested. You were a bit complaining that 2009-2010 compared to 2010-11, the numbers have decreased. To me, it means something is happening. We talk of zero arrest. Now, when the numbers go down, does that mean? Does that mean our police are doing their work, or the syndicate is hiding? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much, Dr. Bega, for your presentation. I only have one question with regard to slide number 7, where you indicated that there was no mention of firearm training. So I just want to find out from you, are you actually, when you see the capacity that the police have with regard to shooting, are you actually doubting as to whether they're accurate in doing their work? For you to mention this one, I only need clarity in that regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I see you've not referred that I saw to the forensic laboratories. I know you've been around long enough since the changeover when they took the blood and the autopsies over to the Ministry of Health. Now, I don't know if you've ever followed up on having a blood test done, but certainly it can take up to 3 years. People, you know, because it has to be clear, drunk driving cases are thrown out on a regular basis because the magistrates will not hold a drunk driving case for over a year on their rolls, and the autopsies also are taking upward of 3 years. I personally don't know that this has assisted the SAP one iota in moving back to the Ministry of Health. Your suggestions, opinions in that situation, and what would you, what would you prefer? Because currently the current situation is not working. It's a disaster.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Chairperson. Slide number 15, Dr. Berger. You talk about the loss of the attribution and the loss of firearms. If I lose one, I'll be prosecuted tomorrow. But if the police lose one, they won't. I don't know. I'm asking this thing as a person who may understand this thing correctly. Is it a negligent on the part of the prosecuting side or on the disciplinary side of the police, or is it what? Where does the line is not drawn in this matter? Because you see, my friend next to me here, I know that he's got an unlicensed firearm, but if I report to him, to the police station today, he will be arrested and prosecuted. But the lieutenant left to her, which is Annalise, she will be prosecuted and so on. Where does the police draw the line in this thing? You see, there is a problem of maybe because we are in the family, we are better off than somebody else outside the family. I'm just looking at that. How can we solve that problem? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you,
Just to correct the gentleman next to you, don't use firearms, you use scarf. Scarf. Chairperson, no, the question that I've got is in relation, and I agree with the comment that was made, that it's actually not really a question, it's a comment to remind ourselves that we rejected the fact that they did away with successful prosecutions. So I just want to remind ourselves about that point. When they came with the performance plan, we said that we do not accept the fact that they're doing away with the successful prosecutions as a performance measurement. So we need to ask them why they continue to report in this way. You will remember the beginning of the year when we looked at that plan as well. We said to them that we don't accept that it's in our reporting fact.
Sorry. Dr. Berg, just one question on this. Is it, I'm just like you, I'm very worried about this number of firearms that are lost. 1,300 something. What is the benchmark in like, have you done any studies? Because I can't understand why so many firearms from the police get lost. Even if there is a decrease, but 1,355 firearms lost. Because that means 1,355 firearms with a criminal. I mean, one firearm with a criminal is dangerous. So, what is the benchmark? Because we've been talking to the police about this thing, even probably tomorrow we'll talk about it. But if we could have the benchmark, what is the situation in other countries?
Thank you very much. Just on that one, I know exactly why. If you visit police stations and you see how police are failing to control their firearms, then you will not be surprised completely. You will not, as a matter of fact, 1,300 is quite low. You would expect more, as a matter of fact, because there's completely no control of such firearms. I do it. I don't have to be a SAPS member. I don't have to be a brigadier for that matter. I'm an ordinary politician. But you go to the next police station now and just check SAPS firearms. You know why they are getting lost. Because you don't know where the firearm number so and so is right now and where it was yesterday. Not recorded anyway. So you will understand some of the things. However, I think you will respond to the question. I also wanted to ask a question on conviction rate, because you seem to be providing an answer, you assume, and we think that the conviction rate should be there. It definitely must be a performance evaluator or indicator, and for whatever reason. Because for me, for instance, this 56% conduct, 57% contact crime detection rate. The court ready case is 32% of that. And therefore the conviction rate will be of that. And property related crimes detection rate of 15%, which is 16% to the nearest. And the court ready cases percent is of the 15%, which is even lower. And probably the conviction rate, and therefore would get a clearer picture if we had the conviction rate as well. And that is what we have been saying as the portfolio committee, say, but we need this one. And because it's going to tell us as to whether people who commit crimes are indeed, they go through the process of the legal process to an extent that they go to jail or they are found guilty on a scale. I think that is missing. Because these court ready cases, when you actually ask deeper even about them, they necessarily not mean that the person will be found guilty or not guilty. They mean the case can go to court, and it's quite a number of things when you ask into this thing deeper and you're interacting with them. I'm also saying that the police station that we visited in Free State, they had a backlog of 8,000 cases, and per month they would take something like 669 cases to court, supposed to be court rate cases. Of those, 647 will be closed undetected. After going to court, you take it that they are court ready cases. 640 something will not stand the test of time in court. And therefore, we remain with this 30 or even less than 30 something cases that probably will go through the process of the court. Now, that is why for me, this is not what I think is correct. We probably will want to see something that has gone through the processes that we know as to whether we have shocked taxes, if I may put it that way. But let me hear from you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I hope I got all the questions. I wrote them on different pieces of paper or on the slides. Can I just say, in general, that I think much of what we are talking about now are symptoms of what is wrong in the police. And we are now trying to wrestle with the symptoms, and we need to dig deeper. And for what it's worth, Chairperson, I wrote an article in the Crime Quarterly in June that I think you might find useful, where I did talk on some of these issues that relates to deeper problems within the police that needs to be addressed. That would hope, if we could solve those problems, much of the rest that we are now talking about would then go away. But let me start, Madam Chair, with your observation also. I think, and I'm not defending the police, I think the conviction rate needs to be in the court. I have no doubt whatsoever it needs to be there. But I do think what they are trying to avoid is a situation where they will be measured by something over which they have not total control. I mean, in terms of getting a case docket ready for court, they have almost all the control. But once it goes to the prosecutor and then through the court process, the role of the police or the influence of the police are more limited. They cannot prescribe what the outcome can be, would be. They cannot even prescribe to the prosecutor whether he's going to prosecute or not. So that all of these things might have an impact. So, but I think if they, these things they can mention in the annual report. But still, I think it does to a large extent reflect then both the police and the criminal justice system as a whole in terms of how efficient we are in terms of investigating those cases that are reported to the police. And therefore, that indicator needs to be there. And there's no way that the police can avoid taking a huge chunk of the responsibility for the quality of the investigation that is sent to the courts. If you say a case is court ready, it means in police language it is sent to court. It is not necessarily ready in terms of the quality of the investigation of that case. And those things are needs to be looked at. So in terms of your question about firearms,
I think we agree with Dr. Berger on the point of most of that in the absence of it as it is, shouldn't they at least then be able to do what the chairperson has mentioned? Give you then the cases closed and detected.
Yeah.
And detected, yeah.
Yeah.
Closed after that.
Yeah.
Because that would then give you a purer indicator of the quality of the investigation. But I do also, and we've done it in the past, because we never held the police alone responsible for the conviction rate. Because we know the influence of court, of crime, that the state court, property does not seem to bear, etc. We know those things and those factors. But we need to have at least one or the other, or both ideally, when you have cases closed and detected, or you have your conviction rate, or both of those.
Thank you, Chair. I agree with that. Can I move to the questions on firearms? I think what you've posed is actually a question that should be posed to the police, precisely what they should be answering. It is completely unacceptable that such a large number of firearms get stolen or lost from the police, and in spite of the measures that the police have put in place, that they continue to lose firearms. And we know that many of these firearms are lost through negligence, through theft, but also through criminal activities of police officials where they actually sell these firearms. So I think it's important that the information is provided to this committee and to the public at large, that we know, and that we also know what the police are doing about their own, who are negligent, who are criminally involved in this. So with that information being absent, in many ways it allows, you see, I think, ladies and gentlemen, I think the problem for the police is that in most of these cases there's no consequence for them acting in the way that they do, either criminally or negligently. There's no consequence. And therefore they will continue with this kind of conduct. On the question of the number of police and detectives, I think we need to appreciate the fact of the 193,000, only about 156,000 are sworn officers or trained police officials. So you have to work your 25% roughly on the 156,000 and not 193. I don't know in terms of, or rather, let me go to crime intelligence. I absolutely agree with that. I think one of the biggest problems, and it's something that, with all due respect, I had personal differences with the previous National Commissioner about what crime intelligence operations means, or intelligence-driven operations, or intelligence-driven or intelligence-led policing, all of these various terms, refer to one thing. On what information do you base your action? And if you do not have that information, you are blind. So you are policing blindly. I mean, it's, with all due respect, I appreciate the fact that we have more visible policing in Gauteng, for example. And visible policing certainly is a deterrent in some ways. But if you don't back it up by something else in terms of concrete policing, then visible policing becomes a laughing stock. You know where these cars are parked on the highways. You're certainly not going to commit a crime in their vicinity. You commit your crimes elsewhere. So visible policing has a limitation. And I think if you look at many of our police stations, and I'm careful not to say most, Chairperson, many of the police stations do not have the ability. They are supposed, the crime intelligence officer at the police station, he is supposed to be briefing every shift that comes on duty in terms of what the problems are, what to be on the lookout for, and debrief them when they report off duty in terms of what they saw, what they experienced, whatever information he can get to include in his picture of what's happening. And then he or she has to continue with their own analysis all the time. We are looking at crime intelligence as the big organization, but they do not provide that kind of operational intelligence to stations and to units. And I think we have a huge problem as far as that is concerned. Sorry, Ms. Van Beek, I just need to go back to, that was what eluded me, the whether we have enough police officers. And I agree again with you. I think, you know, Chairperson, if we look at the international norm, you have two police officers internationally per 1,000 of the population. In the United States, it's 2.8. We are also, at this stage, between 2.7 and 2.8 per 1,000. We have more than enough police officers in this country, and I've not included the metropolitan police officers. Which brings you then back to my statement in the beginning. There are other problems within the police service. The way in which we utilize these resources, that needs to be questioned. And I think that is a problem. So absolutely in agreement, we have enough police officers. I don't think we are always utilizing them effectively. And of course, as I said, there may be many other reasons why this is happening. If we look at, you made an observation about the women at the ISS. Within my program, just to get some sympathy, We are only three senior researchers, and the one is now walking in the Himalayas, is on 3 weeks leave. The other is a female colleague that represents our program on the corrections and you will often see her in the Portfolio Committee on Corrections. So she'll be talking there. I talk on police, and my other colleague Winnie is here also talk on police and other stuff. But that is our program. We have one junior researcher who's developing excellently. It's a female, by the way, but she's still got to grow a little more. But we are giving them exposure. In terms of firearms training and capacity, I think it's almost all of those things. If you talk to criminals, and we have research interviews available. For example, if you look at the study that was done by Professor Rudolf Zinn on house invasions, he would tell you that they are not afraid of the police in terms of police shooting at them, because the police shoot so poorly. So that they think they are better shots, they are better trained in firearms than the police. But this is not my concern with highlighting this thing. My concern is, and perhaps I am biased in the sense that I speak to some of the people involved in the training of police officials, is the issuing of competency certificates to police officers when they are trained. And I am not convinced that all of them are trained and tested to the extent that the law requires before they are issued with competency certificates. So I think that is why it's important that the police gives us a little more information as far as that is concerned. Ms. Kulabanat, you asked the question on forensic laboratories. I really don't have an answer. I've spoken to some senior people, and I've spoken to General Pitt, the 2A was the head of this unit just after he retired, and asked him about the problem. And he also said their problem is all of these things are done by the Department of Health, and that is where the real backlog is. So the challenge, and as I said, I don't know what the answer is. You know, can the police do this? If the police are to do this, the forensic laboratory, for example, it will have to be capacitated. And the problem is with the police in terms of capacitating forensics is the fact that they have a huge turnover in terms of the salary that they can pay these individuals. We don't keep them. So that is the problem that they are constantly, unless they have a completely different salary scale and a different system running. I'm not certain, but I mean it's completely unacceptable, and that is the case. I tested this with them, that they have a 3-year backlog on most of these things. And if you have high profile cases, they might draw it out of the list and put it up in front, and that is unfair, I think, against most other people. Yeah. Okay, let me just see which questions did I perhaps slip. I hope I covered all of them. You asked about benchmark. There's actually two questions. I don't know what the benchmark is, to be honest. I haven't looked at this really. But this is, again, it's like corruption, it's like all of these other things that are in a way hidden. Inefficiency and ineffectiveness are hidden because information are not provided in the report or made public. So I think it's important for us. Here we have trained police officers that are trained not only to use firearms, but they are also trained to take good care of their firearms, to make certain that it is properly safeguarded, because they have to enforce the law in terms of the Firearms Control Act if you and I do not take proper control of our firearms. And now they set this kind of example in terms of allowing themselves to be robbed, or that this might be stolen from them, and in some cases, hopefully this is the smaller percentage, even actively providing these firearms to criminals and then afterwards reporting the firearms lost or stolen. So this is something, and why I'm saying, Chairperson, that this needs to be in the report so that the police can be held properly accountable for this kind of thing, so that we can see if this constantly is coming down, or is this remaining at a high level or increasing. And they need to tell us what are they doing about the individuals responsible, so that we can see that they are acting against their own and not just acting against me and you who lose our firearms. Thank you, Chair. I think I've covered them all.
Thank you very much, Dr. Becker. You said something which I think I have to caution you on. You said normally a criminal seeing a vehicle parked by the roadside that stops the vehicle will not go and commit crime there. Can I tell you, sir, that a politician will go to Guamashu police station I'm not going to go further than that.
You know, the police come with a delegation of about 300, and the media will be here. And the other thing that worries me is working in the NCOP building next door the whole time.
Thank you. However, you said that this room accommodates 60 people, and it would seem like we will use this.
For the whole week.
Very difficult to get accommodation. It's quite limited. So we'll see. We hope that they're not going to bring everybody. They're going to bring relevant delegation. For instance, for administration, the following day will be other people. Yeah.
But we've got a very influential secretary. Can we, in any case, we understand all of that, but can we ask the secretary to have a look at it, please, Chairperson, even if it means trying to swap with another committee, because I mean, we all know what's going to happen.
Yeah. No, we will try. However, for now, this is the way. But if we get something bigger than this, then we'll inform members. I know it's very difficult. Thank you very much, members. Thank you, Dr. Becker. Thank you all. We are meeting tomorrow at 9:30. For now, this will be the venue. If there is any change, that will be communicated to you, and please check your SMSs. Just for 3 minutes, members of the ANC, if they can remain behind. And thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.